From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at what's on the docket for the state legislature and state Supreme Court in 2025. Then we'll speak with this year's Milwaukee Youth Poet Laureate.
I think poetry has the ability to just capture emotions and ideas in a way that's so accurate and so personal in a way that prose can't.
Plus, explore earth-conscious New Year's resolutions with dig-in contributor Venus Williams.
I want to loosen my grip on the earth. I want to do my part to undo the harmful grip that so many of us have on the earth and invite others to do some of the same things.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. There's a lot ahead in state politics in 2025. There's a budget to finalize, questions about how the legislature will operate, and a spring election for state Supreme Court. To look ahead at what's in store for state politics this year, here's WUWM's Mayan Silver with Capital Notes.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. Today we'll talk about developments when it comes to ballot measures in Wisconsin. We're talking to J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
No, thanks for having me.
So Wisconsin voters may see another constitutional amendment on their ballots this coming April. Republicans plan to give final passage this month to an amendment that would put the state's voter ID requirement in the Constitution rather than just in state law. The Senate is expected to pass it this week, followed by the Assembly next week. What can you tell us?
Well, basically, it's trying to take the current state law and put it in the Constitution. Officially, Republicans say that they are worried that the state Supreme Court, now controlled by liberals 4-3, will invalidate the state statute and overturn that requirement. Unofficially, they're also hoping that having the April ballot will drive turnout among conservative voters for the Supreme Court race, when control of the court will be up for grabs. Remember, Ann Walsh Bradley, a liberal, announced last year she's not going to seek re-election. There's a contest then between Brad Schimmel, former Republican Attorney General, Waukesha County Circuit Court Judge, Susan Crawford, a Dane County Circuit Court Judge, kind of the candidate left of center versus Schimmel, the conservative. They're squaring off, and whoever wins will determine the control of the court. So Republicans would love to see a boost in turnout among their base this spring. This is one possible way to kind of help goose turnout come April.
What can you tell us about the conversation around the state's voter ID requirement as it was in the past? You know, what are the two sides or different sides on that topic?
The conversation hasn't changed in years. You know, Democrats complain that the amendments or these kind of efforts will disenfranchise voters, those who don't have an ID. Republicans argue that they're easy to get, that it makes it, their phrase they've used over and over again is easy to vote, hard to cheat. Like, the reality is, if you look at any poll that's been done in Wisconsin for the last decade or 12 years, voter ID is popular. You know, it likely, I'm not going to go out and say for sure it'll happen, but likely, if the polls are correct, it'd pass overwhelmingly. Democrats, though, continue to raise their concern that this is going to impact voters, especially those of color in places like Milwaukee. Republicans have dismissed those concerns, and they continue to do so. So the argument hasn't changed since the thing was passed the first time a dozen years ago.
Turning to another ballot question, in Wisconsin, currently only the legislature has the ability to get referenda on the ballot to ask voters to weigh in on amending the Constitution or changing state law. Governor Evers said this week that he wants voters to be able to do that and to put their own issues before the electorate for a majority vote. What can you tell us about this, and really, what are the chances of this going forward?
The second question is easy to answer. It's not going anywhere. Governor Evers proposed this, arguing that Republican lawmakers have used their power to amend the Constitution to their liking, that if they're going to do it, then basically residents should have the same opportunity. But Republicans have ignored a call like this before another time. Back in 2022, after Roe v. Wade was struck down, Evers called a special session legislature to take up basically a binding referendum proposal that would allow citizens to then put things on the ballot. Republicans ignored that call after this latest kind of charge from the governor. They've thrown cold water on it. Devin Lemieux was a Senate Majority Leader. He said that any policy the governor puts into the budget, they're going to strip it out. This is not really where you should put those things. Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, has said that Evers is trying to undercut the authority of the legislature. Obviously, lawmakers have the sole power right now to amend the Constitution before, obviously with voters weighing in on it, but they're the only ones who can initiate that process. So it's not going to go anywhere, but it puts the governor's putting these guys on record. And also, too, the Joint Finance Committee, the budget committee of the legislature, if he puts this in the budget, they'll have to vote to take it out if that's what they choose to do. And I'll put them on record saying they don't want to give citizens the same power they have to initiate the constitutional amendment process.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WUWM's Mayan Silver speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Redistricting meant new maps in Wisconsin. In the legislature this past November, there's still a Republican majority in both chambers, but Democrats flipped 14 seats overall. What can you tell us about the makeup of the legislature and how you're expecting it to impact whether we see more legislators working across the aisle?
So Republicans go from a supermajority in the Senate of 20 to 11 to 18-15. Republicans in the Assembly from 64-35 down to 54-45. Will it produce more bipartisanship? Not from the people I'm talking to so far. You know, when they look at the Assembly and the Senate, they see the likelihood that there'll be less stuff, big things get done. Now, hey, in 2023, Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers came together and signed off on a package to improve shared revenue for local governments at state aid to cities, counties, villages, and municipalities. Did that. They got a big education package for K-12. Knocked that out. Brewer Stadium, knocked that out. So they got some big things done in 2023. But on other issues, they just don't agree on stuff. And even the numbers narrow in the Senate and the Assembly, that's not going to change. Plus, too, you know, there's going to be pressure on Robin Voss in the Assembly and Devin Lemieux in the Senate to kind of hold the line against Evers. You're going to see Republican, the base, they want to push back against the governor. So we'll see how that works. The bigger question to me is, how is the Senate going to get things done, even things that leadership wants to get done? Remember, at 22 to 11, this past session, Republicans struggled on big ticket items. You know, there was a lot of angst against stuff done. They're down to 18 votes. If they lose one member, that's all they can lose, get something done. Going back over the years, Steve Noss, for example, from Whitewater, he's maybe supported a couple budgets in more two decades. Andre Jacques up in De Pere often votes no on things, or unless he, you know, puts a stamp on them. Julian Bradley of Franklin has sometimes been what part of that kind of more conservative caucus. You know, there are members like that. You kind of go, okay, Chris Kapinga, who was Senate president last session, but was stepped down from that post after it's clear he's not going to win it again. How are they going to work with leadership? Are they going to be amendable to a budget that governors might sign? Or might they say, hey, we want the most conservative document you can possibly pass this Senate, and then force Evers a veto? That's a huge question for how they're going to operate this coming session.
You know, you mentioned the budget. The 2025-2027 budget needs to be passed this cycle. It's a key baseline that Republicans and Democrats have to work together on. Obviously, Evers drafts it. Republicans in the majority in the Joint Finance Committee then take it up. They discuss it. Evers ultimately has a strong veto pen. Is there anything you see getting consensus on this year that the legislature couldn't in past years?
Well, here's one example of the challenge that is going to be faced for the Capitol. Robin Voss, the Speaker, said he wants a tax cut bill done before the budget. He wants Governor Evers to commit to what size of tax cut he'll sign before they even give him a budget or send back his budget. Look, Evers is likely not going to do that from people I talked to. One, if you commit to a number, and then limits how much you can put into your priorities. Two, the governor would lose leverage in the process. You know, if he signs away a tax cut in, let's say, March, and they send him a bill in June he doesn't like, what's his leverage, right? What's his point to push lawmakers like, hey, I'll sign your tax cut if you give me X, right? So likely not going to happen. Then you have Robin Voss saying, hey, from what I can tell from talking to the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, the nonpartisan budget arm of the legislature, of the $4 billion surplus we expect to have in Wisconsin in this fiscal year, roughly $2 billion of that is because of tax cuts Evers has vetoed in the past. That money is all going to tax cuts, period. I won't spend a dime of it otherwise. Okay, well, that's his line. So now what? You know, we're kind of another standoff between the governor and Republican lawmakers about what to do. So it's going to be interesting to watch how the process plays out, if they all of a sudden play nice with each other, or if we're going to have more of a very little gets done in the Capitol, but there's lots of big kind of standoffs on high-profile issues.
You're tuning into Capitol Notes. I'm WUWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. You mentioned the surplus, the $4.6 billion surplus. Evers has said he wants to stabilize the child care industry with some of that money, invest in public education, respond to inflation. Republicans, like you mentioned, want tax cuts. What else do you know about what could happen with that money?
Well, you know, State Superintendent Jill Underley, up for re-election in the spring, by the way, she's called for $4 billion in new state aid to her agency to go mostly to schools. Even Governor Evers, a former state superintendent, said that's a big number, and he's not committing to it. So there's that demand on the state's finances. The UW system, or Universities of Wisconsin, now they call themselves, has asked for $850 million in new state aid. Governor Evers has committed to that. Lawmakers have said, Republican lawmakers have said, no, it's not going to happen. Another demand. So there are lots of agencies that have their hands out looking for some of this money. Again, if Robin Voss and Debbie Leavenhue stick to, we're going to focus on tax cuts, there's not as much around to go around for new spending. So what are the priorities going to be? Oh, there's also this case with the state Supreme Court hanging out there. Remember, the governor uses partial veto authority in the 23-25 budget to basically write into state law an annual increase in school spending for 400 years. Now, that can be changed anytime if lawmakers and the governor agree, or if the court strikes it down. The court was asked in a lawsuit challenging that amendment. Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce, state's largest biggest business group, challenged that, said it went too far. So if that's struck down, that'll be an area of negotiation. If it's upheld, Robin Voss has said that might be it for education. They'll just basically figure out how much they want to fund that spending increase and go on. Because remember, that cap, that increase per child each year, is a mix of what they can spend districts between state aid and property taxes. The more state aid you put in the formula, the less districts raise from property taxes. So what's the appetite of Republican lawmakers to fund that increase going forward? That could be the only question they answer the budget, which Governor Evers called a joke, his words, a joke, to think schools get by on that much money. So he wants to put more than that into schools.
So I'm wondering, you know, the economy and inflation were the top issues of the 2024 election cycle. Both Republicans and Democrats have said they want to do something about it. With Republicans so keen on these tax cuts, what would that look like for the average Wisconsinite? And how are the different, you know, parties approaching trying to help the average taxpayer slash consumer slash person in Wisconsin?
Well, here's a great example. It's not just disagreements between the governor and Republican lawmakers, but GOP lawmakers sometimes don't agree with themselves either. So Robin Voss, late last year, says priority was a new exemption for retirement income up to a certain level, argue that would help keep seniors in their homes and help them afford these rising costs. Devin Leavenhue says, no, I want to do an across-the-board cut. You can't help just one segment of the population. You got to help everybody. Robin Voss says, I love all tax cuts, but I like smart ones, i.e. mine are better than yours. So it's not just, again, whether Evers will sign it, but what might they send to the governor? Will it be a mix of those two things? That's what they'll hash out in the next couple of months, figure what Republicans want to do, and we'll see if the governor will sign it.
How do we anticipate that this will affect the average person? Like, what are they looking at in terms of money back or anything like that? Like, what's the range? And does Evers have a bottom line of what he'll agree to on a tax cut?
Evers keeps saying he wants to do a tax cut that benefits the middle class. So one, define the middle class. What constitutes that? Those voters. So that's what the governor wants to do. But in terms of like how it could impact people, it's so hard to say until we see what these proposals actually look like. Like when they're down on paper, not just an idea floating out there. But, you know, are you going to get rich off this tax cut if you're a middle-income voter? No, probably not. It might help a little bit around the edge. It depends on how big they go and where. Remember, we have, I think, four income tax brackets right now in Wisconsin. They've lowered the bottom three. They haven't touched the top one while Evers has been in office. They've tried to, Republicans have. So where does the relief go? I've heard Republicans argue that we've done so much as a state to lowering the tax burden. We need to go at that top tax bracket because like 7.65%, and Illinois is lower than us for the top bracket. Iowa is. They are a competitive thing. Evers has said no way because that tax cut benefits those who are considered upper middle upper class to the wealthy. He's not going for that kind of tax cut. I would be fascinated to see if they could strike him some kind of deal to give Evers something that he wants in exchange for that, but I haven't seen any evidence so far they can reach that kind of deal.
And what else is on the table to help the average person living here with their economic burdens?
Well, a lot of it's coming from the federal level, honestly. We're seeing talk out of D.C. about Trump tax cuts being extended, no tax on tips the president-elect has been calling for, you know, left and right. Those things are going to kind of trickle down. Energy costs, you know, we don't do much about that in the state level. The federal level could have an impact on those things. So, and then there's a question on tariffs. You know, I'm not an economist. I read stuff that a lot of them say, and most economists I've read say that if you impose big tariffs on everything coming to this country, it's going to cost the average consumer. Now, Trump has argued that that will not happen. We'll see. But I don't know if even if the state cut taxes for all Wisconsinites, if it could offset the possible impact of big tariffs on everything we import, as Trump has promised on places like Mexico and Canada and China.
So you just mentioned Trump and that administration. I wanted to ask you, of course, we're looking at another Trump administration for the next 4 years. What do we know about how Trump's last administration period, how his administration interacted with the GOP-led legislature in Wisconsin? Like, what's the policy relationship there?
Well, you know, they're all on board with tax cuts. They don't agree on a lot of other things. I mean, look at the relationship between Robin Voss and Donald Trump. It's kind of non-existent. Remember, Trump put pressure on Robin Voss to overturn the 2020 election results, even though Robin said that wasn't possible. When Robin said that, then former President Trump got unhappy. How's that really going to work out? I mean, the Republicans are trying to figure out the D.C. level, how they're going to govern, especially their majority in the House. I mean, be interested to watch how that trickles down to the state. They take their lead from what's going on with Trump. We do know, for example, that Robin Voss has said he wants to pass immigration bills, like ones that require, say, I believe he wants, Republicans talked about doing away with sanctuary cities in Wisconsin, talked about requiring cooperation with ICE when it comes to deporting people here without documentation. Governor Evers has said, hey, he's not in favor of mass deportation, so that could be a big fight. The governor's tried to argue that Wisconsin's dairy industry, for example, would be really impacted if there was a lot of people deported because there are a lot of people here without documentation working for dairy farmers. So those could be some big flashpoints with the Trump administration and how the president-elect approaches that promise from the campaign last fall.
And finally, if you had several key ways that Wisconsin residents could get involved with the legislative process this year, what would they be?
Oh, call, write letters. You know, I tell you that lawmakers, when they get a lot of calls from their constituents, it works. I might stress their constituents because if you live in Milwaukee and call somebody in Rhinelander, they're not as much as willing to listen because you're not one of their constituents. But if you have a, you know, if you write and call your legislator, usually they listen. That's just a simple rule of thumb in politics. Do good constituent relations. Be responsive and have an open ear. That helps you a great deal.
All right. Thanks so much, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
Just like Capitol Notes, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. You can search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll talk about ways to include the Earth in your New Year's resolutions. But first, we'll meet Milwaukee's Youth Poet Laureate and learn about her approach to creativity. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's Youth Poet Laureate knows how intimidating it can be to put a pen to paper. Alina Ahmed was selected by Woodland Pattern last summer to help students overcome that fear and spark creative writing. Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez spoke with Ahmed about what inspired her love of poetry and her experience as Youth Poet Laureate.
I want to start by taking it back to the beginning. Where does your love for creative writing and passion for poetry stem from?
I think I've always had a really strong passion for storytelling above all. My mother likes to tell everybody stories about how I used to have these ideas and these stories and these things that I wanted to have down on paper before I could even write. So I would just like come home from the beach and tell her what I did and she would write it down for me. I was very fortunate to grow up in a household that loved literature. So I always grew up hearing my mother talk about the books that she adored and my brother talk about the things that he wrote and have me read some of his work as well.
And do you feel like there was a moment that stands out to you where you realized, this is what I want to do, like this is what I want to pursue?
No, I think there's so many moments, you know? Like, I think it's every moment I shared with my brother, looking over what he wrote and reminiscing over our memories together and having it being, you know, captured so beautifully and artistically in such detail and having that memory with me forever. Or whether it's, you know, I can think of a lot of memories I have while I was performing and just feeling really energized and sort of empowered by the themes that I was able to express and the way I was able to convey my ideas, or just being able to sort of bond with a lot of my friends over the things that we write about and sort of like nerd over, like, oh my God, like I learned how to do this and this is really cool. So I think it's just a lot of memories over the years.
Yeah, I'm getting like a sense of nostalgia and community.
Yeah, I think it's just also because I've just always loved, you know, like talking, communicating, storytelling. So it's in a way, yeah, there's so many memories.
Yeah, I like to say, I don't know if it's a gift, but I say the gift of gab.
Yes, or... yes.
I'm a yabbird.
Oh my God. My friends say that I should go D1 in yapping.
Not D1.
Yeah.
So I also understand that you have an appreciation of art in various forms, but what do you love most about poetry that keeps you connected to it?
I think poetry has the ability to just capture emotions and ideas in a way that's so accurate and so personal in a way that prose can't. And I think because of that, it has this really unique capacity to connect people together. There have been times where I will be reading the work of somebody else or I'll be hearing the work from somebody else and it just strikes me like right in the heart and I'm just in awe of what I just heard because of how personal it is. I think that's why it's so important.
And the emotion.
Yes,
too.
The emotion, 100%. I think because like you're able to use so many different like literary techniques and like it's so precise and it's so specific and it's so, so interpretational. And that way, I think all the time, everybody has something to gain from a poem because it means something different for everybody.
So do you feel like there's anything in particular that influences your work?
Yeah, I think for me, it's definitely my culture and my upbringing, 100%. It always shows up in my work in some way, shape, or form, whether it's the scents I grew up with or the environment I grew up with, the nature, the flowers, like any part of my culture, somehow it just always creeps up into my work.
Can you like elaborate on that?
Mm-hmm. So I have always liked to write, but it's been really back and forth. In eighth grade or around middle school is when I got a little bit more serious with it and I started really sitting down and started honing into my craft. And I remember I wrote this one poem about sort of like generational cycles and like I was talking about like my immigrant parents and the strength that comes with that. And I was always using nature. I was always talking about Bengali flowers, so like a Dolon Chapa or a Nilkamal, or I was getting really specific into these, what I was surrounded with, I guess, because I've lived in both Bangladesh and America. And I think some of my fondest moments or like memories are from Bangladesh, where I see all these, you know, all the flowers that I grew up with and the cooking and the smell and everything.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that with me. You know, you became Milwaukee's 2024-2025 Youth Poet Laureate in May. Why did you decide to apply to this program?
I think I was just really interested in becoming a better writer and also learning about other writers as well and figuring out, well, how can I make an impact? Like, how can I utilize what I do to help bring to light, you know, certain social issues that maybe people haven't heard about before? Or how can I help other people reach their artistic potential as well? And I think in school, I help run our creative writing club, where I've always hosted a lot of workshops. And that was just always my favorite part, was just teaching people how better to express themselves and tap into maybe a part of themselves they haven't really seen or thought of before through writing and through art. So I just was looking to do that at a greater capacity, I guess.
Yeah. So do you feel like you've done that so far? Or what are some of the things that you've done as Youth Poet Laureate?
Yeah. So far, I was a student intern at Woodland Patterns Poetry Camp. And that was a really, really, like, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the sort of, you know, like, I like the workshopping and the helping students on, like, one-to-one, offering feedback and looking through their work and seeing just how diverse poetry can be. It's definitely going to be one of the highlights of the laureateship for this year.
And so I imagine you probably saw the students grow too.
Oh yeah. It was very, very fulfilling to sort of help them navigate through that journey and figure out, because again, writing is so personal. Everybody brings their own sort of energy and enthusiasm and technique and story to it, like no matter where you come from. So it was really interesting to see people figure out like what clicks for them, what works for them, what expresses one piece in a particular way.
Yeah. What are some other things that you've done so far?
Yeah. So most recently, I performed at Milwaukee Scores alongside Dasha Kelly Hamilton, who is the founder of the program, which was really, really nice. I always love performing and sharing my work, whether it's sort of based on something social impact related or just sharing a piece of my soul. And a couple of weeks ago, I also performed at the Brunch Raiser alongside Juan Felipe Herrera. And I actually had a really nice conversation with him where we bonded over our love of psychology, I guess, and just, you know, the impact poetry can have on people, like, mentally, which was really nice. But performing is always one of my favorite parts of writing, always, and just being able to share and connect with people in that way as well.
Absolutely. And something that you mentioned earlier, too, is I know as part of this program, you work to highlight social justice programs, such as the Vell R. Phillips Juvenile Justice Center. Can you tell me more about the project you're working on with them?
Yeah, of course. So currently we are collaborating with the Vell R. Phillips School and the Juvenile Justice Center to fundraise and collect books for their library. We're going to do that through Woodland Patterns Poetry Marathon, which is the biggest annual fundraiser, and it's going to be held hybrid for the first time ever. It's going to be at the St. Kate Hotel on the 25th of January, and we're going to be raising money through our poetry hour and the sort of sponsorship that we gain from that. I will be reading alongside Emily Igwike, who was the first Milwaukee Youth Poet Laureate. And we're going to be reuniting with former Poetry Camp students. So it's going to be really exciting for sure.
So you mentioned earlier that you really enjoyed working with students of the Woodland Pattern Poetry Camp. How would you advise other young creative students such as yourself to get started in writing poetry?
My favorite thing that I'm always excited to sort of teach or like host a workshop in, or like whenever I get the opportunity, is I try to sort of work through the idea of like writer's block, whether it's like in school or anything. Like I always try to weave that in somehow because I feel like it's the biggest thing that writers struggle with. And for a long time, it was the biggest thing that I struggled with, was sort of these really perfectionistic and sort of self-restricting thoughts that held me back from getting something really productive and valuable onto the paper. Because the way writer's block works is you're trying to edit and draft at the same time when those should be two separate processes. And I think oftentimes that really just inhibits me from getting something down on paper that could be productive. So I think the message I would have and the sort of advice I would give is to just be welcoming with yourself and freeing with yourself and to not restrict yourself. Like, whatever comes out will come out. And something my brother always told me growing up was like, well, you can't edit an empty page, because he knew that was something I struggled with as well. So,
yeah, no, I totally relate to that. I felt like you were preaching and I relate. So, well, now that you mention it and how you work to overcome writer's block, I'm interested in learning how you craft a poem. What's that process like for you?
Well, it can be different. It can be really, really spontaneous. Sometimes I just look at something and I just feel an urge to capture it. I'm just like, I have to get this down in some way. I think I just tend to find poetry in places that maybe you wouldn't expect at first. I find in conversation constantly, I'm like talking with my friends and I'm like, oh, that's kind of poetic. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, no, there's something there. Like, there's a prompt in there. There's some theme that I can connect or some motif I can make. And that's the thing about poetry, is it can come from anywhere at any time.
In unexpected ways.
In unexpected ways, for sure.
So I understand that you have a poem of yours you'd like to share. So please go ahead.
So this is called Turmeric Stains. And it's my favorite poem right now, because I wrote this about sort of love across space and time. And it has this sort of duality of just like being frozen in time. And it's sort of, it's like limiting and not limiting. And it's kind of like bittersweet. So, you used to stand still, pinned to the earth like rock amongst waves, spindled with salt that burn against wound, and yet you left yours open, colliding with minerals centuries old under the bleeding sun. Rays dispersed into shards of crystal turn infinitesimally small between my feet and spill into a melange of saffron and paprika across air as I breathe in the years between us that inched us separate, inched me further. Allow the turmeric beneath my nails to dissipate under warmth, lift under light, and question its existence in your presence. This bay turns balm, thick and solid amidst movement, but not yours. You melt in eternity of motion into this frozen space I wish could stay still forever.
That was beautiful. Alina, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for sharing some advice and your really impactful poetry with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Alina Ahmed is a junior at Nicolet High School and is Milwaukee's Youth Poet Laureate. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. Milwaukee County High School freshmen, sophomores, and juniors have until March 30th. to apply to be Milwaukee's next Youth Poet Laureate. You can find more information about that at WUWM.com. We'll have some tips for those taking part in Dry January in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll look at some resolutions to help you better connect with the earth in the new year. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's the start of the new year, and many of us are thinking about what we want to do and who we want to be in 2025. For Dig In contributor Venus Williams, that includes a deep exploration of how she's engaging with the world around her. Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center, and she regularly joins us to talk about all things gardening, healthy food, and cooking. She joins me now to talk about her resolutions for 2025. Venus, thank you as always for being here on Lake Effect.
It is always wonderful to sit with you, Joy, and with our listening community.
Now, we are entering a new year here. It's been a really interesting winter so far. I think, especially weather-wise, it's warm and then frigid and then warm again. And to me, the kind of back and forth really speaks to, I think, where a lot of us are right now. As you enter into 2025, what are you thinking about?
I am really in deep thought and consideration about my relationship with the earth and all of its creatures and all of the elements. As I think about how I want to continue to live and breathe and move and have responsibility on this planet, I'm really considering what it is I need to be doing into this new year.
A lot of us will have resolutions for the new year. It might have to do with our own, you know, physical health. It might have to do with what we're doing at work or with our families. For you, as you look at your relationship to the earth, to our world, what are some of your resolutions?
Well, I started with the word resolution itself. And of course, like many of the words we speak, you know, it's rooted in a Latin word that means to loosen or to undo. And I don't think I've ever really thought about that when it comes to the word resolution. So for me, I want to loosen my grip on the earth. I want to do my part to undo the harmful grip that so many of us have on the earth and invite others to do some of the same things. So these resolutions, obviously resolutions are very personal, but it's me taking conscious steps to minimize my ecological footprint through the actions that I take. And one of the first ones that I am sitting with is reducing the chemicals I use in my home. It's a delicate balance because, of course, we need to kill harmful germs and bacteria, and we want a clean house. And so how do we do that without using these things that are going to go into the water or into the air and into the soil that cause harm? We get comfortable, folks like myself. You know, you can walk into my kitchen and you'll see dishwashing liquid that is great for the environment. And you'll see surface cleaners that work well. But when I went downstairs about a week ago to wash my clothes, I'm like, oh, shoot. So isn't it time to switch out your laundry detergent? And then it made me look at my toilet bowl cleaner, what I'm using to clean my wooden floors. So there will be a lot more white vinegar and baking soda and apple cider vinegar in our lives here. And I'll also use more essential oils that are incredibly useful in killing harmful germs and bacteria, along with purchasing more earth-friendly products. I will spend more time creating more earth-friendly products for our home. And of course, my body is part of this earth. We don't think about ourselves as creatures of the earth. We think about the animals and the insects as creatures of the earth. But I also want to look at what I am putting on my body. And of course, we all know in this city that I make a lot of very organic, helpful body products. So I had to consider what body products am I using that are not good for the earth. So there's the bubble bath. So I have to find a natural organic bubble bath and see how I can do better in that area.
When it comes to the parts of your life you examine kind of through this lens, do you feel like that's just an ongoing process?
It is a constant process if we allow it to be. And we have to be extremely intentional about it, because those of us who are considered the experts or the leaders in these movements and in the movement related to caring for creation, we get stagnant too. You know, there are many areas that I have to continue to look at. Packaging. I want to buy more in bulk and reduce that packaging waste. When I tell people that I ask my God and the earth for forgiveness, each time I throw something away, they kind of side-eye me or chuckle or just look at me like I am crazy. But it is true. I am deeply troubled by landfills. I once was a part of a group that purchased in bulk together. I would love to be part of such a group again. I don't want to have to start one, but if I have to, I will. But I know that there must be groups in the city of Milwaukee who are doing some bulk purchasing. That is where my interest lies. I also am very conscious about the restaurants that I support that have sustainable practices. So I've been fine with going to restaurants that are farm to table and support local growers and local makers. But we also need to look at what are they giving us for takeout packaging? If I am at a place and I see that they're using styrofoam for their doggy bags, so to speak, then I'm not coming back. I'm like, well, is it okay to not come back? Or maybe, Venus, you need to engage in a conversation. So I have engaged in those conversations. But also sustainable practices are about how a place is treating the workers, because again, we are part of the earth. So when I ask someone who is my waiter or host at a restaurant, what is it like to work here? How are you treated? How are you fed here in this space? They're like, is she a plant? Is she going to go back and talk to the owners? No, I just want to be very conscious about even the grip that our practices have on the people who are feeding us, who are part of this earth ecosystem. And in that light, I am resolved to preserve more food in a variety of preservation methods this year. I do an excellent job with herbs, of course. I do a little bit of freezing, but nowhere near what I once did. So I want to dehydrate more food beyond herbs. I want to learn how to can this year. No, I do not know how to can. I have been afraid of doing it wrong for many years and harming someone and making someone sick. I have a root cellar in my basement that is just a storage mess right now. It is my intention that it will look very different this time next year. So I am going to take a preservation class, and we're going to host such classes at the table this winter.
Very nice. I will say, I do some drying, I do some preservation that way, a bit of freezing, but making that leap to canning can be a little scary. It's so easy to go wrong.
Yes, it is. But in order to do that, I have also decided to grow more food. Again, people are like, what do you mean you're going to grow more food? I grow way more herbs than I do fruits and vegetables. I am going to grow more this year. So I'm thinking that if I grow more, I will preserve more. But along with that, there is this myth that those of us who are engaged in this work are just doing such a better job at being in relationship with the earth. Most of my time outside is work, 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 work. Another one of my resolutions is to be in nature more beyond my farming and outdoor work, and to start a nature journal. So I want to do more of the things I did when my children were growing up. I want to go to the lake. I can still play in the sand. I want to go to the wonderful nature preserves we have in the area. I want to take more hikes, walk some trails. I want to be still and observe the creatures around me this year. And then I want to write about it and express my gratitude for all that makes my life possible.
As you're thinking about the next year, reconnecting and connecting with the earth in a variety of ways, what are you reading? What are you reading right now?
So there are two things, two very different books. One is The Complete Dehydrator Cookbook, How to Dehydrate Fruit, Vegetables, Meat, and More. It's by Carol Kanceler, Kancler. So it's a very practical book that I'm reading as I decide what I'm going to grow this year. So I'm going to grow things based on the recipes and the process that I'm reading in this dehydration book. But the book that is really at the heart of all of this is The Seven Circles, Indigenous Teachings for Living Well. And it's by Chelsea Luger and Tosh Collins. And it is actually a book that we are going to be introducing this spring as one of our reading circles. The Seven Circles really just is a reminder for all of us, but especially those of us who come from Indigenous roots here in this nation, that we need to do a better job. And we were born as people who did have a better relationship with the earth and better living practices. So I just want to reconnect in an intentional way to more of those traditions. And I also want to always bring other people along with me.
Amazing. Well, here's to a lovely and grounded 2025. Venus, as always, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for allowing me to be present, and Happy New Year.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fonte Food Center, and our regular dig-in contributor. At WUWM.com, you can find all of our previous dig-in conversations. If you're doing Dry January, we've got some locally sourced ingredients you can use to mix up an NA cocktail this month. Here's WUWM's Audrey Nowakowski, chatting with author Jeanette Hurt.
Happy New Year, and with January also brings a tradition a lot of people partake in, which is Dry January. So when it comes to companies or makers, brewers who are in the non-alcoholic spirit realm, what is their customer base largely made of? I'm sure they get a lot of traffic this time of year, but non-alcoholic drinks aren't just for January.
No, they're not. What is most interesting is if you talk to manufacturers in the non-alcoholic spirit realm, they will tell you half of their customers drink sometimes, which is not just for Dry January, but as a regular course because it's a Monday and they don't want to drink because they have to work the next day, or they're pregnant, or they're on medication, or they just don't feel like it, or they're the designated driver too. So there's a lot of reasons, but one of the blessings of this modern age is you can now decide to have a non-alcoholic cocktail that doesn't taste like a sweet non-alcoholic strawberry daiquiri.
What are some tips when someone's going to be making a non-alcoholic drink for themselves that you'd recommend?
Well, the first thing you're going to want to do is chill all the ingredients, because ice has an important purpose in alcoholic cocktails. It balances things and it eventually melts and it mellows out the alcohol. If you're using ice in a non-alcoholic cocktail, you're just going to water it down. So that would be the first thing. The second thing I would say is you want to consider balance. You want to consider elements of bitter and sweet and sour, and how do you combine them? I would say it doesn't hurt with non-alcoholic to add a tiny, tiny bit of saline solution if you want to wake it up, or a little bit of bitters. Now, most bitters have a little bit of an alcoholic base, but it's kind of like vanilla extract. You're not going to drink the whole thing. That's another thing you can add to your cocktail. And there are some non-alcoholic bitters on the market as well. But the main thing is balance and to try to play with the ingredients. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. And if you think of certain cocktails that you like, how do you emulate them?
So on that note, do you have a couple of suggestions for us with local non-alcoholic products?
Juniperay, for example, it's one-to-one replacing gin in cocktails. So I think you could make an easy gin and basil sort of smash. So you could muddle some basil, lime, a little bit of simple syrup, add the juniperay, and maybe top with a little bit of seltzer, and then you have a lovely cocktail. What you could use with gentiana is, let's say you're looking for a bitter kind of liqueur aperitivo route, you could use gentiana to replace something like Campari in a cocktail and see how that tastes. And I think, again, if you like something sweeter or sour, there's nothing wrong with your taste buds, because your taste buds should guide what you're drinking, whether it's alcoholic or non-alcoholic.
Definitely. Well, thank you for these suggestions. I'm sure a lot of people will use them far beyond January.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jeanette Hurt is a writer and author. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll tell you about an exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum that looks back at its own history and ahead to its future at a new location. Plus, Wandering Wisconsin will help you plan a trip to enjoy one of the state's most popular outdoor winter pastimes. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.